top stories, the U.S. threatens Chinese companies with economic punishment in case they help Russia against Washington's possible sanctions over Ukraine. Bahrain's main opposition group denounces as unlawful any security or military agreement between the kingdom and Israel. And the early release from prison of a white former U.S. police officer convicted of killing a black teenager provokes an outcry from civil rights activists. And those were the top stories. Welcome to the program. The United States renews its allegation that Russia plans to invade its neighboring Ukraine. The Pentagon says Russia plans to film a fake Ukrainian attack to fabricate a pretext for a real invasion. The U.S. Defense Department says part of the fake attack by Ukraine would include videos of corpses and destroyed locations. The U.S. State Department has made similar accusations. Both departments have offered no evidence to back their claim, only saying that it came from intelligence. Britain was quick to react, urging Russia to de-escalate. Russia vehemently denies plans to invade Ukraine. It believes the West is deliberately creating tensions near Russian borders and says it's worried about its own security. Russia says its troop buildup at the border is aimed at self-defense. The standoff between the U.S. and Russia over Ukraine now expanding into China. Washington warns Chinese firms over evading export controls and sanctions the U.S. says will impose on Russia if it invades Ukraine. Washington says it has an array of tools it can deploy if foreign firms, including those in China, get around U.S. sanctions. It says Russia will not be able to make up for the consequences even if it gets closer to China. The reaction came after China and Beijing. China said that as Beijing and Moscow had coordinated their position on Ukraine during a meeting between their foreign ministers. Russian President Vladimir Putin has also met his Chinese counterpart Xi Jinping in Beijing. Moscow denies U.S. allegations that Russia prepares to invade Ukraine. Moscow says Washington wants to drag it into war. A Danish court has found guilty three members of anti-Iran terrorist group of spying on behalf of Saudi Arabia. This is according to local sources in Denmark, whose courts have found three people of an anti-Iran terrorist group guilty of spying on behalf of Saudi Arabia. Regarding the story that I just read for you, Einar Tanger, who is a political commentator in Beijing, says the world is at a dangerous time given the existing mistrust and misinformation coming out in light of tensions, including those on Ukraine. Take a listen to what he had to say.
Well, we're at an unprecedented, dangerous time. You have distrust and disinformation that's being spread. Russia accuses the U.S., U.S. accuses Russia. Now they're trying to add China. This on top of the U.S.'s apparent goal of keeping its hegemony by suppressing both Russia and China and any other nation that it does not feel is in tune with it. This is the kind of thing that happened in World War I when Great Britain was the great power and was trying to maintain its hegemony. So extremely dangerous. It's not that anyone wants war, but you could have these countries sleepwalking into one.
Bahrain's main opposition group, Al-Wafaq, says any security or military agreement between the kingdom and Israel is unlawful and has no legitimacy. Al-Wafaq says the Bahraini regime is in crisis and has no authority to take such actions on behalf of its people. The group also slammed a Thursday visit by the Israeli Minister of Military Affairs to Bahrain, saying it crossed red lines. During the visit, Benny Gantz signed a security agreement, the first between the regime and the Persian Gulf Arab state. Bahrain and several other Arab states established diplomatic relations with Israel 2 years ago under U.S. brokered deals. Palestinians see normalization with Israel as a stab in their back and a betrayal of their cause. Activists in the U.S. city of Chicago called for justice after a white former police officer convicted of murdering a black teenager in 2014 was released early from jail.
We're demanding a full-scale investigation and prosecution. Now, we also made this demand in 2016. So we're asking the Department of Justice to give us a status on it. We want to go forward with this. Under federal statutes, Title 18, Section 242, he can be indicted for murder, tried and prosecuted. And that's exactly what we want. That's exactly what we want.
Justice is on trial now. That's what Chicago's Catholic priest father said at a rally against the early release of ex-cop Jason Van Dyke. He was freed after 39 months in prison instead of serving an 81-month sentence. Chicago authorities say the ex-cop showed good behavior while in detention. Van Dyke murdered Laquan McDonald, 17 years old, in October of 2014, but he was charged more than a year later following public pressure. That happened after a released dash cam video showed Van Dyke shooting McDonald 16 times within seconds as the teenager was walking away. African Americans have long been subjected to brutality by white police officers, with a majority of cases going unpunished. The United States has approved some potential weapon sales to its allies in West Asia. The U.S. Defense Department says some countries, such as Jordan, the United Arab Emirates, and Saudi Arabia, are included. According to the Pentagon, the approvals included the possible sale of F-16 fighter jets to Jordan and spare and repair parts for Hawk missiles to the UAE. Riyadh was also okay to buy equipment worth $24 million to upgrade its missile defense systems. Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates have been witnessing increasing retaliatory attacks from Yemen over a war they launched in 2015. The Yemeni army has pledged more attacks inside those countries if they do not stop their deadly airstrikes. The war on Yemen, now in its seventh year, has entered a new phase. The Yemeni army has targeted positions inside the UAE on more than one occasion to drive home the message that the country should stop being a party in this devastating, indiscriminate war. But the U.S. has offered to prop up support for the UAE by deploying an aircraft carrier and fighter jets, a sign of its growing engagement in the conflict.
The U.S. appears to be getting more involved in the war on Yemen. The Pentagon is dispatching a guided missile destroyer and fifth-generation fighter jets to the region amid increasing retaliatory air raids by Yemeni armed forces on vital facilities in the United Arab Emirates. The Pentagon is reportedly reviewing a range of actions to support the UAE. These include providing early warning intelligence, collaborating on air defense, and sending the U.S. Navy guided missile destroyer, the USS Cole, to partner with the UAE Navy.
The fact that the United States is ramping up its war and aggression against the people of Yemen symbolizes that U.S. imperialism is in a state of decay, of chaos, and crisis. A rat, a vicious animal, is most fearful and most brutal when it is cornered, when it is left with no other options.
The United States military has also launched interceptor missiles in response to Yemen's retaliatory strikes that targeted the United Arab Emirates. The interventions are seen as a widening U.S. involvement in the war on Yemen. The war was launched by a Saudi-led coalition, which also includes the UAE. The U.S. had officially suspended its offensive in support of Saudi-backed militants. The UAE hosts some 2,000 U.S. soldiers and serves as a crucial base of operations for the deployment of armed drones and F-35 stealth fighters.
The U.S. wants to keep expanding its war machine, and unfortunately, the people of Yemen have been devastated by U.S. Western imperialism through Saudi Arabia as its proxy by constant bombings. Yemen is one of the most impoverished nations, not because of the Yemeni people, but because of the brutal attacks launched on Yemen. Hundreds of thousands of people have died.
Much has been said about the war in Yemen, but one of the lesser-known aspects is the UAE's use of mercenary forces in ground battles. At the height of the war, the UAE had a small army of mercenaries numbering around 30,000. The U.S. military trained those forces inside the United Arab Emirates. It also made sure that there was a steady flow of arms to keep the war going. The UAE announced in 2019 that it had withdrawn from the war, but as evidenced by later developments, the Persian Gulf state is still heavily enmeshed in the conflict.
The Emirates is Saudi Arabia's main ally in the bloody war on Yemen. The Saudis are trying to change the ruling structure in favor of its former Riyadh-friendly official. The Yemeni forces and the allied fighters from the popular committees have vowed not to lay down their arms until the country's complete liberation from the scourge of the Saudi invasion. Most recently, the joint forces carried out three operations which saw them strike targets deep inside Dubai and Abu Dhabi. The first operation took place on January 17th with five ballistic missiles and a large number of drones. 1 week later, Yemeni forces pounded the Al Dhafra airbase along with important targets in Dubai. They also hit a number of military camps in Sharura town of Saudi Arabia's Najran and strategic sites in the kingdom's Jizan and Asir regions. In the third operation on January 31st, Yemen's Zulfiqar ballistic missiles and Samad 3 drones struck targets in Abu Dhabi and Dubai.
Apart from the United States and the United Kingdom, the usual culprits when it comes to imperialism and war, one of the other actors, bad actors, in this horrible, atrocious war that has been taking place is the occupying settler state of Israel, an apartheid state based on the exploitation and colonization of Palestinian people. Israel, even though Israel doesn't necessarily have boots on the ground, so to speak, in Yemen, it's still financing the technology, the weapons of the chaos that's being ensued in Yemen through its financial schemes, through its banking institutions, its geopolitical interests as well.
The UAE has helped Israel establish strategic bases in the Yemeni island of Socotra. The bases will be used to collect information from across the Gulf of Aden, including Bab al-Mandeb and south of Yemen, which is under the control of forces backed by the UAE.
What we're seeing is that Israel has been playing a behind-the-scenes role this whole time, bankrolling the war on Yemen, bankrolling the genocide of the Yemeni people, and interestingly enough, their secretive role, their shadowy role in this war is now being revealed. The curtain is being pulled on Zionism, and it stands revealed for the world to see just how bloody it is.
Socotra has been a source of tension between the UAE and Saudi Arabia, which have been vying for control of the resource-rich island. UAE-backed separatists of the so-called Southern Transitional Council, or the STC, took control of Socotra in June 2020 in a move described as a full-fledged coup.
Iran's Islamic Revolution is being recalled globally by those who were of age to witness its immediate impact, and for others who continue to feel its international legacy, Amina Taylor is in London with this report.
It is the revolution that continues to reverberate around the globe. Iran's Islamic Revolution ushering in a new age by ousting the US-backed Pahlavi regime. Father Frank Gelli, who became an ordained minister, recalls his initial reaction when news of the revolution broke.
At the time, I considered myself quite left-wing, so I enjoyed the idea there should be a revolution against the Shah. So I considered the Shah a tyrant.
One of the most inspirational things about the Islamic Revolution for its many admirers is not just the impact that it's had inside of Iran, but it's the growing legacy that it continues to build globally.
For political observers, Iran's stoic path proved an innovative and bold new model where alliances could be forged and solidarity fostered.
Because of its anti-imperialistic values, that's why Iran has good relations with lots of other countries around the world, Muslim and non-Muslim, that have also suffered colonialism and occupation. I mean, it could be Cuba, it could be Venezuela, many countries in Africa around the world, who, you know, have a certain affinity with Iran because of that.
There's also another element to those who admire the aims and accomplishments of the revolution.
The Iranian revolution, as I mentioned, it tells us how you don't have to have only one model of political system, whereby, I mean, here in this country we have a monarch who is head of a national church, but it's a farce. In reality, God has been pushed out of the public sphere, and so the whole thing is a charade. In Iran, there is a valuable presence of faith in the public sphere.
As the revolution moves towards another remarkable milestone, the West still continues its opposition campaign despite a lack of success.
I can't think of too many examples of countries around the world that have withstood the barrage of war, sanctions, media hatred, internal subterfuge, kind of instigated from outside, that Iran has. Yet they're still here. And they're not just surviving by the skin of their teeth, they're thriving as well. They have a strong military. They have strong regional allies. They have political influence, especially within their area in the Middle East. I think that it's widely recognized, even by haters of Iran, that Iran is one of the major regional players.
With its legacy still rippling across the globe, supporters of the Islamic Revolution internationally know they owe Iran and Iranians a great debt. Amina Taylor, London.
And that's it with international news.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
Path towards enlightenment.
In the name of God, the All-Compassionate, the All-Merciful. Salam and welcome to another episode of our weekly series titled Path Towards Enlightenment, which is an endeavor to make you and us familiar with an easy and fluent explanation of God's final scripture to all mankind, the Noble Quran that was revealed to the last and greatest of all messengers, Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. We continue from where we left you last Friday, and here are ayahs 44, 45, and 46 of Surah Tur.
وَإِنْ يَرَوْا كِسْفًا مِنَ السَّمَاءِ سَاقِطًا يَقُولُوا سَحَابٌ مَرْكُومٌ فَذَرْهُمْ حَتَّى يُلَاقُوا يَوْمَهُمُ الَّذِي فِيهِ يُصْعَقُونَ يَوْمَ لَا يُغْنِي عَنْهُمْ كَيْدُهُمْ شَيْئًا وَلَا هُمْ يُنْصَرُونَ.
Were they to see a fragment falling from the sky, they would say, a cumulus cloud, though it could be a semblance of divine wrath. So leave them until they encounter their day, on which they will be thunderstruck. The day when their guile will not avail them in any way, nor will they be helped.
Thank you.
you remember, in our explanation of the previous ayahs of this surah last Friday, we said that among the methods to invite misguided persons is to raise logical questions to awaken their dormant conscience and make them contemplate upon the manifest truth. The real losers are those who obstinately stick to their wrong ways in spite of their relentless efforts through rational measures of the prophets and the saints to deliver them from the darkness of disbelief, which eventually leads to their own destruction. The ayahs that we recited to you now mean to say the intransigent disbelievers are so obdurate that even if they see some matter fall down from the sky as an indication of divine wrath, they would call it a condensed cloud falling on the earth. This is nothing but denial of the sense of perception towards the manifest truth in a vain bid to escape from facts and realities. There is no hope for the guidance of people who have so immersed themselves in sins and disbelief that this has darkened their vision and turned them into enemies of the prophets and of the divine message. Ayah 45 tells the Prophet of Islam not to feel grief or sorrow for their refusal to believe in the message of salvation, but to leave such intransigent people to their own fate until death awakens them from their ignorance and they taste the never-ending torment of the day of reckoning, which they had denied and which will strike them like a thunderbolt. As the next ayah says, they shall have neither refuge nor deliverance on the day of judgment on which their stratagems have failed them, leaving them to the punishment they deserve for their vicious deeds and vile words. From these ayahs, we learn that 1. Obstinacy blinds the vision and the perception to sense spiritual realities. 2. Guidance avails not those who seek truth and reality. And 3, the intransigent disbelievers mock the manifest truth without realizing that they cannot escape the wrath of the all-merciful Lord who gave them respite. Now let us listen to ayah 47 of the same surah.
وَإِنَّ لِلَّذِينَ ظَلَمُوا عَذَابًا دُونَ ذَلِكَ وَلَكِنَّ أَكْثَرَهُمْ لَا يَعْلَمُونَ.
Indeed, for those who do wrong, there is a punishment besides that, but most of them do not know. This ayah refers to the fate of the wrongdoers who, after comprehending truth, try to deny it or attempt to defy it in quest of worldly greed on the assumption that they are smart enough to escape divine punishment. For such sinners, firstly, they deserve torment for their disbelief, whether indulgence in atheism or polytheism. Secondly, they have not only wronged themselves by indulging in vices instead of acquiring virtues, but have also left no stone unturned in trying to harm the Prophet and the disbelievers, especially the Ahl al-Bayt, or the blessed household of Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. If only they had used their God-given intellect to realize the result of their deeds, thus their torment will be twofold and different from those of the other disbelievers. The phrase, "there is another punishment besides that," may also indicate worldly torment in the form of either divine wrath that befell the disobedient nations of the past, or such calamities as famine, floods, diseases, etc., before death and the punishment of hell. This ayah teaches us that, number one, the punishment for those who not only wrong themselves through sins and disbelief, but also purposely wrong others out of animosity towards truth, and the believers, especially towards the Prophet and the Imams, is twofold. And number two, one should not persist in ignorance, but use the intellect to discern between truth and falsehood, with sincere repentance in the divine court. In conclusion of this week's episode of The Path Towards Enlightenment, we recite ayahs 48 and 49, which also mark the end of Surah Tur. Inshallah, next week, we start explanation of Surah Najm.
وَاصْبِرْ لِحُكْمِ رَبِّكَ فَإِنَّكَ بِأَعْيُنِنَا وَسَبِّحْ بِحَمْدِ رَبِّكَ حِينَ تَقُومُ ومن الليل فسبحه وإدبار النجوم.
So wait patiently for the judgment of your Lord. For indeed you fare before our eyes, and celebrate the prize of your Lord when you rise before dawn. And also glorify him during the night and at the receding of the stars. In these ayahs, God Almighty tells the Prophet of Islam to be patient against the disbelievers who wrong him, and to continue propagation of the divine message despite the harm done to him by the enemies, since God is the Almighty Protector. The Prophet is also bidden to glorify the Lord Most High and recite his praises on rising from sleep before dawn. This address is applicable to the rest of the Muslim community as well, and it is incumbent upon believers to be conscious and cognizant of God Almighty at all times, despite worldly preoccupations, by heeding divine injunctions and abstaining from wrong. At the end of Surah Tur, God tells the Prophet to glorify him during the late hours of the night and at the time the stars begin to disappear with the break of dawn. This is a reference to the late night recommended prayer, which is not obligatory, but whose performance indicates the firmness of faith of the believers, and according to a hadith, is better than the worldly possessions. It is worthy of note that worshipping and glorifying God Almighty in the heart of the night is quite different in terms of serenity and a spiritual delight. May God Almighty bestow upon us the blessing of waking up early at dawn and praying to our Creator. Amen. These ayahs teach us that, number one, God helps those who strive in His way and strengthens their faith and patience. And number two, prayers and supplications have a profound effect on the heart, mind and spirit, and grant the strength and resolve to eagerly fulfill divine commandments.
Bring us out from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of instrument.
The Spotlight.
When it comes to the standoff between the U.S. and NATO with Russia over Ukraine, there seems to be a key development that changes the dynamics. Now Ukraine has come out and said that the U.S. in particular is hyping the situation and has elevated to a war scenario. In this edition of the Spotlight, we will look at why the U.S. is taking a more aggressive stance against Russia and whether the U.S. reluctance to not meet Russia's security demands will end up in a war or not.
Ukraine. A country in Eastern Europe making the headlines these days as it remains a source of friction between its neighbor Russia and backers in the US-led NATO alliance. Corporate media have been trying to portray Russia as an aggressor, bombarding their audience with reports on the country's troop deployment at the border, its military drills, as well as moving blood supplies to Ukraine. Can the international community fall into yet another war trap in a scenario set by the West on a likely Russian invasion of Ukraine? But the question is, given the US-led NATO's eastward expansion and transfer of their lethal weapons and troop bases in Eastern Europe, which one is the real aggressor, NATO or Russia?
When the Soviet Union fell and the Warsaw Pact had already been ended, since then, NATO has added 14 more countries, and nearly all of them are countries that were either republics of the Soviet Union or allies of the Soviet Union.
Ukraine is simply a pawn on the Western chessboard. The U.S. has already sent several consignments of weapons as part of a multi-million dollar security aid to Ukraine while planning more troop deployment. America's allies, Britain, France, and others, have also put their forces on alert. The massive propaganda has even prompted the Ukrainian leader to urge his Western counterparts to avoid stirring panic over a Russia invasion. The West claims Russia is building up troops at the border to invade Ukraine. Moscow denies any such plan, saying its troop mobilization is simply defensive. It says the buildup also aims to counter NATO aggression. The military alliance has conducted several war games near Russian borders, three of them jointly with Ukraine, which is not even a member of the military alliance. So, what's the real game plan? Analysts believe the US wants to integrate Ukraine into the American Empire by granting it a NATO membership, a message hidden in Washington's response to Moscow's security proposals.
This makes the Russians see red spots before their eyes, the same way as any talk of Mexico, say, joining a Chinese military alliance would make them freak out in Washington. It's not a difficult problem.
Russia is seen to reassert its place in the international arena, and its proposals for a diplomatic resolution to the Ukraine standoff seem reasonable. A possible military conflict between the European Union and Russia would entail massive human losses and economic harms. Undoubtedly, Russia has grown increasingly concerned about its security because of Western weapons and forces deployed to its doorstep. The corporate media have played a vital part in fueling tensions, and the US, that has waged numerous wars overseas, knows very well how dangerous provoking a war with Russia will be.
Our guest joining us for this edition of the Spotlight, representative to the UN from the Schiller Institute, Richard Black, joins us from Hackensack, New Jersey. We also have radio host, journalist, and political activist Don DeBar, who joins us from Ossining, New York.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to you both. Don DeBar, first to you. You have the U.S. pretty familiar with the stance of the U.S. at this point, very pro-militaristic in nature, 8,500 troops on heightened alert. They have told Ukraine, we're going to keep giving you arms. They just delivered, I don't know how many hundreds of tons of arms based on the latest report. And then you had the Ukrainian pro-war president that I'm going to take on Russia changing stance. Of which his latest quote was, he said, stop creating panic. And he said, we don't need this panic. What is going on here? Is there a change of stance from the Ukrainian president?
It's hard to parse what things are real and what things are for public consumption, because there's a great deal of both moving parts in play right now. You have a pronouncement from Lukashenko about... he's basically playing the same role that the Ukrainian president is playing, let me at him, hold me back, in other words, you have two paper tiger, mad dogs that are your proxy, sort of like a 21st century version of Yugoslavia and Albania when the Soviet Union and the People's Republic of China would have a public dispute. These would be their proxies. First, in terms of all of the things that are going on, who's their hostilities and what's going on, there are satellites, networks in the possession of both sides of this that they've been using for 50 years now. They know exactly who has what resources deployed where. So you have a discussion, for example, where people say, okay, well, if they're going to put the troop, U.S. and NATO are going to put troops in Ukraine, and they're going to try to foment color revolutions, quote unquote, in Belarus and Kazakhstan, and you look at a map and it starts to look like Operation Barbarossa, because that's true, by the way. You look at a map of the fullest extent of the Nazi invasion in the early 1940s and where NATO is now and where they're trying to go. They'd be starting Hitler's invasion from the front lines instead of from Germany, which is the Russian strategists are well aware of this. Uh-huh. So people say, well, suppose they put resources in Cuba, Venezuela, Nicaragua,
right,
and then the United States, there's a huge outcry, we will not allow that to be severe consequences. Well, and then you have from Lavrov and Putin a statement that we are now reaching deeper relations, economic, social, political, and military. Vague. So that stuff is for public consumption. The United States knows exactly where every piece of Russian and Chinese military equipment on the planet is, as do they know where every piece of NATO, etc. So there's a real game that's going on between the two militaries and intelligence agencies and right. The deep government in case. And then there's this TV show we're watching. It's hard to parse which is which.
Well, one of the things that Richard Black, Don DeBar said there is the fact that how Ukraine can be, in a sense, a proxy for the U.S. I mean, we know that there was a color revolution that happened in Ukraine, but we're looking at how just in the past days the Ukrainian president has changed stance. Another one of his quotes, Ukraine's stability is of great significance. And he said, U.S. is panic-triggering alerts are placing a heavy burden on the economy. It seems like there's a diversion. Do you think there is one?
Yes, it is the case that President Zelensky has made the point repeatedly in the last days that certain forces in the West, typified by CNN, Truss of Britain, and others, are talking about an imminent invasion of Ukraine by Russia, which does not exist. The Ukrainian leadership keeps saying it does not exist. The Russian leadership has said it does not exist. So something very nasty and dangerous is coming out from what we had identified since the days of President Eisenhower as the military-industrial complex in the West. Today, Britain calls itself Global Britain and is pushing the pouring of weapons into Ukraine like mad. But step back a second. First of all, NATO became obsolete in 1991 when the Soviet Union disbanded. And what is required, the solution, is a new security architecture involving all of Europe, based on the principles of the Treaty of Westphalia of 1648, which ended massive religious warfare in Europe. The principle of diplomacy in a seemingly intractable situation is nations acting for the benefit of the other. I don't believe that President Biden wants a war with Russia. The American people don't want a war with Russia. And it's imperative that the United States...
What does he want then? What does he want when you say that? When you say Biden doesn't want a war with Russia, what does he want? Because it sure smells like one.
Not necessarily. If you look at the transcripts and the videos, the media continually attempts to goad him make provocative statements against Russia, and he keeps saying, we'll see a little bit, I'm not sure. I want to stress to you that there are significant forces in the United States, typified by former Ambassador Matlock to Russia, former Ambassador Chas Freeman to Saudi Arabia, former CIA Chief Graham Fuller in Afghanistan, who have all been calling very, very loudly and vociferously for a pullback of the U.S. offensive against Russia and calling for accepting the very recent proposals of the Russian Federation. Similarly, in Europe, many, many, many nations and leaders are saying this has to be slowed down.
Okay, let's get into that. I was going to get into that a little bit later, but Don DeBar, you had this interesting document which the U.S. decided not to release the details. It's very confusing as to the way that the U.S. approached this, not wanting to make it public, and for Russia to make parts of it public. But basically, I don't know if you saw that press conference where you had the U.S. Secretary of State presenting this document and saying, we're offering Russia a roadmap. But it sounded like it was a roadmap for the U.S. and not for Russia, because none of Russia's demands were met. But of course, he didn't want to come out and say that, Anthony Blinken. At the same time, he was very vociferous when it came to how much weapons they're giving Ukraine, how their allies, U.S. allies in the Baltic states, for example, that are going to be getting more weapons. It's almost as if the U.S. had the gun down Russia's throat, saying, if you don't follow what we are proposing, then this is what you're going to get. Did you get that impression?
Well, I saw the press conference. What he delivered was a reply document from the United States. There was one also that came from NATO. There were reply documents to a pair of proposals, again, one to the United States and one to NATO, that Russia delivered on December 17th of this past year. And it wasn't a roadmap. He used the word roadmap here, from Blinken's mouth. I'm thinking of this image from the Johnny Carson show when they used to say a fake commercial, meet at the fork of the road, and there'd be an actual fork and then a bunch of squiggly lines behind it, a map that was useless to anyone trying to go anywhere. Russia laid out very plainly what the concerns are that they have, that they would like to negotiate a settlement, you know, basically a global settlement with the United States and NATO, that you promise not to move your alliance up to our doorstep, in fact, not to even take military equipment into Eastern Germany at that time, East Germany, let alone into the Warsaw Pact countries, Poland, Czechoslovakia, the whole lot of them, Romania, Bulgaria. And so what happened instead was not only did they take most of the, and this was a point for Blinken, that someone misspoke on a TV show on RT and said practically all instead of saying most, but almost every member of the Warsaw Pact is now a member of NATO, along with the three Baltic states, Lithuania, Latvia, and Estonia, and some other Soviet republics. And then on top of that, you had an attempted coup in each of Belarus and Kazakhstan that are clearly tied to the CIA. I mean, there's been millions, and well, there was $5 billion, according to Victoria Nuland from the U.S. State Department, Assistant Secretary of State for European Affairs, that was spent in, you know, the lead up to the Maidan coup, basically developing the communications infrastructure, including three TV stations that were used during the. This kind of thing has been going on in all of the old Soviet republics around Russia and in East Europe. And so Russia is seeing this, and they're seeing the troops that they fought when Germany invaded rolling in with greeted, you know, being greeted by the locals, realizing the troops are being placed there for them.
Well, you know, what's interesting about Richard Black, is the fact that in some cases we're looking at a Europe that has been somewhat conspicuously absent from the talks. I mean, remember the talks the week before where you had Wendy Sherman doing the negotiations with the Russian envoy at that point. And then there were news that it was the U.S. that was making the bidding for Europe, but not all European countries are on board. Why is it that Europe is not present, not actively present when it comes to the talks?
It is absolutely the case that there's a process that has emerged in Europe in which within many, many of NATO countries, the answer to war with Russia over Ukraine is absolutely no. Croatia has said we will not send troops. The Hungarian foreign minister is saying we need to negotiate long-term energy deals with Russia. Macron just had a long conversation yesterday with President Putin. President Putin just had a seminar with leading Italian industrialists earlier in the week, and a new one is being set up between German industrialists who want peace with Russia, a new video conference with President Putin. So in fact, it is the case that there, Blinken is lying, that there is a great deal of light between the positions of the nations of Europe and the United States. And Europe knows that it will go up in a nuclear holocaust, since it is the host to American nuclear weapons, if there's a war between, and let us be clear, we're talking about the possibility of a nuclear war between the United States and Russia. That's what's at stake here. And as I said earlier, I don't believe the U.S. Commander-in-Chief, this is my view, the Shalvinsky's view, it's not our view that the President, Commander-in-Chief President Biden, wants a nuclear war with Russia, and that's what's at stake.
Mm-hmm. Well, given that that's what's at stake, maybe that's why you're having these Eastern Ukraine talks, as it's called, Donbas, in which Russia, Ukraine, Germany, and France are voicing support for what it seems like a ceasefire, maintaining a ceasefire.
Yes.
And this kind of is like the negotiations that were called the Normandy talks. Maybe you can take us back. That sounds an awful lot. Awful lot like the year 2014 when he had the Ukraine crisis in a sense break out, and then there were these talks. What were the Normandy talks? Are they feasible? Are those talks feasible to lay groundwork for a ceasefire? This will be for Donbas. Go ahead, Donbas. I'm sorry.
Okay.
Get back to you.
Say Normandy, there's actually an agreement, the Minsk agreements. And the Minsk agreement was, in essence, the key parts of it that the Eastern Ukraine republics, particularly I believe Donetsk and Luhansk, I don't remember if the third one was part of the agreement as to this part of the deal, they would become autonomous within, you know, the state of Ukraine. They would be autonomous governments, and this would resolve the contradiction between Kiev and the people that live in the east, in essence, because the domestic political situation in Ukraine is fragmented. It has been for, you know, a very long time. The people in the east are ethnic Russians. The people in the west are a composite of ethnic Poles, Lithuanians, you know, and others from, you know, more or less Western Europe. You have the whole, you know, historic schism between the Orthodox and the Roman Catholic world. Kind of that's a fracture line also that runs right through it. And the cultures that have evolved over many years. And by the way, most of Ukraine on, in both of those spheres, up until the last century for sure or so, were part of Russia for centuries. And so there are many contradictions on the ground that represent political constituencies, for example, that Zelensky has to deal with. Like Zelensky came in, he was elected as a peacemaker, he was going to resolve this dispute between the West and the East, and he got elected despite that fact, not because of it, in the West, because he was a TV star, and I think that's why he was chosen as a candidate. Once he got in, he has a balancing act with these constituencies on the ground, and there is a very strong fascist element that has a very strong shock troop on the ground constituent that he has to deal with, and the United States is using that as sort of a forward guard to intimidate Russia, and it's really dangerous the way that that's playing out. I'm just going to go to one last little point. In the 1962 Cuban Missile Crisis, as it's called here, which is actually because the U.S. put missiles in Turkey in 1961, that when Kennedy did that, everybody involved, Robert McNamara, Fidel Castro, Khrushchev in his memoirs, tell you that it was sheer luck that we didn't have nuclear war. We're playing now, it literally, Russian roulette, firing another shot and hoping the chamber is empty. And I don't know if Joe Biden, no matter what his intentions are, is up to it the way that John Kennedy was. And that's what we're gambling with right now.
Gambling. Russian roulette. Richard Black. Provocations. This is very similar in a sense to what the U.S. is doing when it comes to the South China Sea and the way it's provoking China. I'm not too sure what foreign policy structure or plans the U.S. has by being involved in these big, what looks like adventures. Maybe you can tell us what is going on here. Because, you know, Russia and China, obviously these are big powers.
I think you probably know the answer to the question, which is that there's a faction in the Republican and Democratic Party and in the U.S. media as a whole which wants the United States to be the world hegemon. And in the West, there's a very deep, deep global financial crisis. Hyperinflation is out of control. The debt structure in the entire West is a disaster. And what they're proposing as a solution is continued massive hyperinflation to keep the bubble going and the Green New Deal to get the world, including Iran, to get out of fossil fuels and out of nuclear. China is not accepting this. Russia is not accepting this. So China and Russia are both targets of this war faction in the West, which is proceeding out of desperation. At the same time, I would make the point that a new strategic element in the world as a whole is this unique collaboration now between China and Russia. They are inseparable from the standpoint of economic policy, development policy, strategic policy, and therefore, in the West, those who would push the West towards war may be facing war against Russia and on China simultaneously, and this hopefully will function as a wise deterrent.
Okay, Don DeBart, my last question to you quickly, if you can. The Chinese ambassador to the U.S. issued a warning, possible military conflict over Taiwan. So my question, what are the chances of the U.S. being involved in a military confrontation with China compared to one with Russia?
You want Jimmy the Greek, not me. That faction that Richard speaks of, by the way, exists. The faction is called Congress, the White House, Langley, the Pentagon, the Supreme Court. every other institution of power that the United States has, and the media. That is the war faction in this thing, the one that wants hegemony. There does not seem to be a constituency outside of the political forces organized around Trump and maybe somewhat around Sanders that are even willing to consider the possibility of a multipolar world rather than this hegemonic one that they've been striving for, certainly since 1991. But 1991 is really a product of the striving before that.
Okay, thank you very much for that. Don DeBar, journalist and political activist there, and a radio host.
Can
from
I make one point?
Richard Black, I'm sorry we're fresh out of time. Representative to the UN from the Schiller Institute, who spoke to us from Hackensack, New Jersey. We'll bring you on for another program, I'm sure. And with that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikhail Vitafoy and the entire team, it's goodbye. Until next time.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
Back to reality.
It's the show where we discuss the most topical of topics, the most controversial of controversies, and the most important affairs of affairs.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Dear listeners, sisters and brothers from every single corner of the world, wherever you are, I hope you're doing well and everything is fine with you. This is IRIB English Radio, and today I have the privilege to be your host. I am Asma, and with us, we have two dear friends and guests in the studio. Welcome, brothers. Would you please introduce yourself to us?
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Brother Habib at your service, representing California.
So, welcome.
My name is Sayyid Abdullah Al-Musawi, and I am from the land down under.
Okay, that's very good. Welcome to the program. So pleased to have you here. Well, we're all buckled up for you to take us back to reality. Here's the thing. There are the human beings who live in this world, and since they're made of flesh and blood, and they have heart and brain, which means like a cauldron of mixed feelings and emotions, then there are fears and dilemmas in their lives. What do you think would be the greatest fear of human beings who live in this world?
First of all, I want to understand what the meaning of fear is, and from the viewpoint of my brother, Sayyid Abdullah. But me personally, I think that fear is that, you know, that sense of feeling in one's soul and spirit, mentality, you could say, of falling into disaster or disruption, or, you know, that just, you know, it's a simple meaning, it's a self-evident meaning, just trying to explain what someone feels during that intense moment, during that, you know, say, drag of soul and drag of mentality towards something, or towards away from something.
So before we go to the word fear exactly, I would like to ask a question. Do you think if we were immortal, we would not have fears?
No, we will still have fears.
I think the fear is mostly coming out of the fact that we are not immortals. We can't control things the way we want.
The thing, the idea is, I think we, as a human beings, we live our everyday life thinking that we are immortal, don't we?
No, still we have the fear that
we act like
no, subconsciously we're acting as if we are immortal, because if we do act and actually feel that we are immortal and we feel that death is going to come any minute, we will be scared catless, if I can say the word.
So we are scared.
If we're scared, then why do we sin?